Welcome to today's episode of Bites of Insight by Arete. In this episode, we'll dive into the education sector, specifically K through 12 schools. We're uncovering the emerging threat posed by a new cybercriminal group called FOG, which has been targeting school districts. We'll explore why these attacks are proving successful, the factors making school districts vulnerable, and the essential steps to prevent these cyber threats.
All right. Well, welcome, everyone. Welcome to Bites of Insight. My name is Vinny Secor. I'm the VP of Business Development, really focused on working with insurance carriers, insurance brokers. And I'm joined with my fantastic partner, Yevgeny Urchov. So, Yevgeny, why don't you just take a minute and just kind of introduce yourself, give everybody your background, and then I'll kind of dive into our topic of the day.
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you very much for having me. So my name is Yevgeny Urchov. As Vinny mentioned, I'm head of security research at Arete. I've been working in like ransomware-related incident response niche for like field for over 8 years now. And in my current capacity, I'm kind of involved both in the threat actor negotiations, so I've had a chance to get insights from all the ongoing cases, and also play also a role like on cyber threat intelligence team. So we collect more than 200 data points from each engagement, and it helps us to figure out like what the bad guys are doing and track them like throughout history.
Yeah, and Yevgeny and I have known each other for, gosh, I'm going to say almost 7-8 years now. When I was at NetDiligence, I formerly before joining Arete, I was the CTO at NetDiligence, also taught at Messiah University, taught cybersecurity. So I've kind of been around the block. And prior to that, I was at Verizon. I was their HIPAA security officer. So I know just enough to be dangerous. And I would oftentimes lean on Yevgeny for his expertise. I think, Yevgeny, you know, you have a pretty interesting law enforcement career as well. Would you mind just kind of sharing a little bit in terms of what you've done on the law enforcement side?
Yeah, sure. So before going into incident response field, like in my former life, like for several years, I served as U.S. Army Cyber Operations Officer. So like for several years, I had a cool opportunity to work on a team that tracked state-sponsored groups. Obviously, you can tell by my accent that I wasn't born in Idaho. So like you can figure out like which groups were my favorite back then. And I also spent some time working as a federal law enforcement agent, working on cyber criminal cases. So chase cyber criminals for a living as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe in one of our future episodes, we'll have to post a picture or two of you in your early law enforcement days. There's some fun ones floating around the internet, you know how that is. So one of the reasons why I wanted Yevgeny to talk about his background is, so you understand the perspective we're coming from. You know, at Arete, our mission is to stop cybercrime. So there's always going to be on every episode a heavy element of, I'll just say, angst towards the bad guys, if I could just say it that way, because what we really want to do is we want to stop cybercrime. So today's episode, we're going to focus on the education sector and specifically K through 12. I think probably the best place to start is that there is a new ransomware threat actor group calling themselves FOG. We've recently posted some things about it. There's a technical blog coming out soon, and probably our next crime report will probably highlight them just because of how active they are. And typically, our threat intelligence team doesn't use the term target because with threat actor groups, but it's clear from what they've told us that this group, FOG, is indeed targeting K through 12. So Yevgeny, maybe we could start there with that question is, what are we seeing with respect to FOG? What do we know about them? We'll start there.
So this group is fairly new. Initially, we observed, I believe, in April of this year. But the interesting part about them is that those guys definitely know what they're doing. So most likely, it's kind of a rebrand of the group that operated in the past, potentially maybe a brand new group with folks that left other teams potentially. So we don't know that for sure because a lot of tools that they use are commonly available. So it's not something unique from perspective of like trying to do the attribution and tracking them to like, okay, like you guys are XYZ group that we see in the past. But they did show a pretty high level of sophistication. So especially once they get on the network, they showed capability of using multiple different techniques to bypass antiviruses and endpoint detection and response solutions. So they definitely do the research once they get inside the network. They pretty proficient on how they move laterally and bypassing all the detections. They're pretty effective in that area. And from the primary intrusion vector, for majority of cases that we got, we've seen them using credentials either for VPN or RDP. So potentially they might be getting those from some of the dark markets.
Okay. And so I think what I've heard our team talk about is that they might be working with access brokers. Would you agree with that?
That's correct. So it's not uncommon for ransomware groups to actually kind of outsource the initial access to the network. So typically they can go out on some of those forums or dark web markets and procure access to the networks that other guys already gained. And after that, they just leverage those initial credentials and move laterally, like elevate their privileges, try to find all the sensitive information, deploy ransomware, steal data, and get out.
And so the other piece of information I heard is that the threat actor group has put out something called the Fog Blog. You know, very unique name, I guess. It's good marketing, maybe. It's something easy to remember. But, you know, knowing that not everybody that's listening to this episode is at your level, would you explain for our audience when a threat actor group says, hey, we're publishing a blog, what does that mean? Where is it located? What's the purpose of it? All of those types of things.
Of course. Yeah. And definitely a very catchy name for the blog. This approach is fairly common nowadays. So initially, the first group that started using that approach, I think it was fall of 2018, if I remember correctly. But the idea is that each of those groups try to maintain thing called shame insight or data leak site. And they publish initially just an announcement. Okay, we reached compromised company XYZ. We about to release their data unless they decide to pay it. Essentially, they are trying to use that as additional leverage or to apply additional pressure on the victim, because not only a victim would be concerned about can we restore everything from backups or can we roll back to the previous state or even rebuild some systems from scratch, but they're also concerned about what type of data potentially was taken from their site. Since some of those blogs can be found and are found by journalists all the time. So they all of a sudden, those victims start to get questions from the media, from their partners, or even in some cases from their employees. So it's fairly effective way to apply pressure on the victim, and the bad guy is just trying to maximize their chances of getting paid.
Where would somebody like me or one of our listeners, where would we find these blogs? I mean, do they post on Twitter? Are they on LinkedIn? How would somebody that is just kind of not at your level or an expert actually find one of these blogs?
Some of the groups actually maintain blogs on normal internet. And if you would Google for a specific ransomware group, there's a pretty good chance that you'll find the link. But a lot of those groups also try to hide location of the infrastructure, and they use what's called Tor, Tor network. At the end of the day, it still looks like typical browser. You just would have to download and install on your machine. But on the back end, it uses Tor network, which hides the origin of the server. And you can access their data leak sites and shaming sites using that browser.
And so for one of these schools, one of these K-12 schools, one of these school districts that's being hit, would you say that probably more than likely they would not know to look for a leak site?
They probably will not have a capability to detect that something was posted on the leak site, because I wouldn't think that a school would be tracking and scraping and running keyword checks on all the sites that are out there. But I'm sure they would find out that it's something is available fairly quickly, because somebody would start asking questions. So in some cases, we've seen even law enforcement, not just journalists or somebody else trying to reach out the victim, but in some cases, law enforcement notifies them as well.
So typically, if I'm the member of the IT staff or the administration or somebody that works at a school district, what I'm hearing from you is that typically what happens, especially with a group like Fog that is targeting K-12, that's established a blog, is that they will infiltrate, then they'll, we use the term exfiltrate, they'll actually steal data, and then they're going to post it, and then that's what they're going to use as leverage to demand a ransom.
That's correct. So groups like Fog, they would try to get attention of the victim first before they even would publish something. But eventually, if nobody is reaching out to them from the victim side, eventually they will publish something just to get the attention. And as I said, usually what we see, and it's not unique to Fog, majority of other groups do the same thing. Initially, they would just put out an announcement. Okay, this is a XYZ company. This is the background on them. This is how much data we allegedly stole from them. And some groups even have the countdown clock that will show like when the actual data files will start appearing on their blog.
Oh, wow. Wow. So let's just say we're, you know, we're employees at a school district, we're running IT, assuming we're going to probably get a ransom note or something. Maybe they have identified the email addresses of the administrators, and then they send an email with a ransom note. What do you typically see in terms of with the education sector, the response side look like? Like what happens after something like that happens? You know, is cyber insurance typically involved? You know, what typically happens?
In most cases, especially for cases that we receive, in most cases, cyber insurance is definitely involved. So they have some type of coverage. And that should be the first call that the school should make, because every insurance provider have already predefined legal support, a predefined incident response support, so they can effectively put team very quickly together. And that team will guide the school like through the whole incident response process. And to make the end, the goal would be to get them back up and running with as little damage as possible, as quickly as possible.
What I've experienced working with school districts is that they're almost like a small community, right? It seems like there's a pretty solid organizational level among school districts, where one school district will know the leadership of another school district, maybe because they serve in, you know, they're organized in a regional way, and so they attend the same types of meetings. Do you find that when a group successfully targets one school district in an area, they continue on? Or do you find that a different type of pattern with how these attacks are happening?
I mean, from the communication standpoint, we definitely see that a lot of school districts, especially like once one of them would get hit, like start to compare notes. So they definitely have that like channel of communication throughout the community. They share the best practices. Like we even were invited earlier this year to present at one of the education conferences, PASBO, Pennsylvania. That's a pretty cool thing about the schools, that they do have that back-end channel, especially on the IT staff and CISOs and CIOs level as well. From targeting perspective, it really depends. Typically, like with Fox, so we suspect that they use access brokers. So it's not necessarily means that like if one school in one district was targeted, then another school from the same district or like nearby can be targeted as well. It really depends on how access brokers got access to begin with. It could be just one off. They only were lucky to compromise credentials for a specific school, and that's it. But there's obviously challenges when schools basically use shared infrastructure. So then potentially there may be links that may enable the cyber criminals to kind of expand with access they already have to one, like through shared infrastructure, and access others.
When you talk about shared infrastructure, and I've heard this from a couple others on our team, that school districts tend to share resources with other government agencies. Maybe the ISP is a government-run ISP or something along those lines. Is that what you're referring to when you say shared infrastructure?
Potentially, yes. So, for example, it can be a data center that's being shared, like that has like a bunch of virtualized servers, and that data center hosts servers like for like several different schools. But potentially, if the bad guys are able to gain access to their hypervisor infrastructure, that virtualization enablement infrastructure, they can hit multiple schools at once. Because at the end of the day, on the back end, all those virtual servers sit kind of like in the same area.
Talk to me a little bit about why threat actor groups. And if I remember right, there was another threat actor group called Vice Society, and they seem to also highlight the education sector as something, an area that they went after. Was that higher ed or was that also K-12? I'm just curious if you remember.
It was a mix. So like we've seen both with the Vice Society. There are definitely some similarities between Vice Society and FOG, especially based on the percentage of victims that that are from like education sector, because it's almost like one-to-one, like two-thirds of victims that FOG announced like fall like within the education sector. And we observed the same thing like with Vice Society. So it existed back in 2022, but then like after middle of 2023 was still, like pretty much gone. So, but it's not uncommon. Like we see it all the time. Groups would announce a retirement, then shut down. Then like a few weeks later, we see like a new group coming out with a new name. but there like would be some similarity. So we don't know for sure like if it's the same group, but yes, like from targeting perspective, they were kind of similar.
And I think maybe I'll just probe there a little bit more if that's okay with you. When you say we see things that are similar, what are you referring to? For those of us that aren't in the day-to-day, we're not communicating with threat actors, we're not seeing, you know, incidents on a daily basis. What are you typically seeing that would cause you to make the statement this group is similar to this other group that we've seen?
Similar, like I would say, like in a sense of like, it's really more like when it comes to the threat actor attribution, it's more of an art than a science, because like groups don't, like rarely groups have very like unique capabilities that can like pinpoint exactly, okay, like you keep using like something unique and you move forward. But both groups use similar set of tools, but majority of them are open source. So it's not something that was uniquely designed by them, purely by the targeting profile, because it's not very common for ransomware groups specifically to target education sector. Typically, we see just like especially with sophisticated group, we see the education sector being only a portion of it. The large percentage of victims being specifically like from education sector, it's not very usual.
I think we could say safely that, you know, here at Airtail, we've seen hundreds of incidents with school districts, even more if you include the higher ed incidents. Let's talk a little bit and let's educate the community on what it is about school districts, what it is about higher ed that causes it to be a good target for threat actors.
Yeah, I think probably top three main reasons. Like is one is schools and school districts are set up. It's a fairly large, what we call in the industry, attack surface. Because like you have to deal with computer classrooms, you have to deal with remote connections by students from other locations. So, and like rarely I see schools protecting actual personal devices of those students, so they're connecting with their devices to their school networks. I don't think it matters how many times you would ask your students to complete security awareness training. I'm sure you always will have those curious individuals. They just want to try to do something they're not supposed to do. So like, I wouldn't be surprised that percentage of somebody clicking on the link or that they're not supposed to click or trying to open an attachment they're not supposed to attach is probably fairly large compared to average within the industry.
It's almost a opposite, right? So in corporate security, we're trying to teach all of our corporate users to not be curious, to not click on things, to not do things. But in education, the goal is to embrace a student's curiosity, to encourage them to research, to explore. You know, I remember when I was teaching at Masai University, I'd always bring in, actually, you've spoken to one of my classes before, and I'd bring in some of the IR folks from our ransomware advisory group. And I would always ask them this question because I wanted the students to hear the answer. I always ask this question, what is it you're looking for when you want to hire somebody for, you know, DFIR, right? Digital forensics incident response. And they all of you said the same thing. We look for curiosity. Like what makes somebody great at cybersecurity is that they're curious. But what makes the education sector, based on what you're saying right here, a challenge is that they're curious. So it's the greatest strength is their greatest weakness, right? So talk to me a little bit about, because this surprised me when we were prepping and having a conversation before this, you specifically mentioned computer labs. And so talk to me a little bit about computer labs and what you see there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like the scariest example that I can think of is, so like if your school offers application development classes, that means that you have users with rights on the machine that would allow them to compile code and execute it to test it. So like nowadays, you can actually get a source code of ransomware variants and different type of exploitation tools. And just the thought of that potentially a student can like build something like one of the like compile like either exploitation tool or ransomware binaries or et cetera and start trying them on the network are pretty scary. Because like unless you have the whole network completely segmented and it doesn't touch anything else, so like in worst case scenario, like that student will just destroy all their neighboring devices, like in the web. Like if segmentation is not there, the damage can be pretty significant.
Yeah, you know, the first day of class, I would usually teach the students how to virtual box their own laptop. And because I would tell them, I said, well, here's the deal. I want you to destroy your own machine, not any of ours, right? So just, I'm going to do a quick recap, and I have like one more topic I want to cover with you because we only have a few minutes. So what we're saying is, in terms of like, what's the threat profile in schools? One, that there's a sensitivity of the data. I think you were mentioning to me earlier when we were chatting that it's a highly emotional set of data. K through 12 data, you know, is like data on kids. And so that causes a high degree of emotion. You know, we tend to look at an attack against a school district intensely, if I could just use that term. Like, it really gets us upset when we see a threat actor going after a school district. It's similar to going after a hospital or a doctor's office. It's like the definition of evil, in a sense. And, you know, the other thing you mentioned to me was underfunding. A lot of times these school districts don't have the same level of funding that, you know, an Amazon or a large cloud provider might have. The budget's not there for the tooling that's necessary. We talked about the types of users. We talked a little bit about computer labs. And we talked about the reliance on other government resources. And as a result, as governments are targeted, one of the collateral damage elements could be if a county's targeted, that maybe the school districts in the county are also hit as a result of an attack on the whole county, right? Is there anything else that I missed from our previous conversation?
Well, I think we pretty much covered the majority of the issues. And as you mentioned, insufficient budget is definitely number one, because yes, you can, there are tons of different solutions in, like, on the market that can make the environment very secure, very protected against cyber attacks and ransomware incidents. But like, you have to figure out what to put your money at. You cannot just buy everything.
I'd like to kind of go and kind of close with is, it's an interesting data point that that our threat intelligence team, our CTI, CTI is cyber threat intelligence. And so what our CTI team told me is that of all the incidents that we've handled, about 50% of the school districts actually did have an endpoint detection and response, an EDR system. And, you know, we consider EDR to be one of the best technologies for mitigating, you know, risk and keeping threat actors out. So the question, you know, the second question was what's going on if 50% of these incidents, you know, the school districts had EDR? And what we found, and when we dug deeper, is that 90% of the school districts that had an EDR reported missing an alert. So maybe you could take a couple minutes and talk about, like, okay, what does that really mean? What's the danger, in a sense, that isn't being covered by just implementing an EDR system? If you could talk about that, that'd be great.
EDR is definitely a very wise investment, but to your point, it has to be configured right, and somebody has to be watching it. Anecdotal evidence that we see a spike, at least for the last 2-3 years, we see a spike of incidents in the second half of the summer, like while the school is still out. And I think part of the reason for that is, since students are not in school, most likely staff and IT workers from the school are also taking vacation at the same time. So there's just physically less defenders that may have seen like an alert, or may be able to act on an alert if it's seen. So it definitely plays a role in that, I believe.
So it's interesting that you talked about summer school schedules, because I actually asked if there was any patterns. And one of the patterns that was reported back was that there does seem to be an increase in incidents that occurred during the summer. And so, you know, and I was just pondering, I'm saying, okay, is it because the threat actor groups target schools in the summer, or is it because of like what you just said, because of vacations and things, there's a lack of monitoring? Any thoughts on, you know, the mindset of a threat actor? Do they know that the summer is a high risk point, you know, for vacations and things, or do you think it's just the way that things have worked out?
Yeah, it's really hard to say, because like when we hit, I think it was a year or 2 years ago, and it was like end of the summer, and all of a sudden we started getting incidents that like were within the education sector. And like my initial thought to myself was like, why would you target a school during this summer? Because you deployed the ransomware, like your intent to disrupt, to make this incident as painful as possible. And you would make the biggest impact if the school would be in session, because by killing the IT infrastructure, they can only conduct in-person classes out of using textbooks or something else. But like everything, like all the virtual training, remote training, immediately not available. The more I thought about it, it has to do with actual IT staff taking vacation as well, because it enables bad guys to stay on the network for longer without being detected. They can take time to do research on what type of data is available, like what systems that it can access. So it provides them more time to operate and get the data, sensitive data, and deploy ransomware out.
You know, I hadn't thought about it from the persistent threat standpoint. That because there isn't as much monitoring in the summertime, or there isn't as much activity, that they can get in and they can stay in without detection longer, which is really interesting. And, you know, we asked our CTI team and some other folks, like, what are some things that from a monitoring standpoint that you should look for? And I think two things I was given information on. One was from a defensive perspective, monitoring for data that's going to foreign IPs would be something you'd want to look at, a main indicator. And then the other piece was that, you know, implementing drastic DLP measures, DLP being data loss prevention measures, doesn't really work for schools. And could you maybe comment on that for a minute or two and move on?
I think it kind of ties back to our discussion about the budgets, because like if budget is limited, you definitely would have to prioritize what type of solutions are you putting in place. So like your probably first two would be like first of all would be like multi-factor authentication solution to be put in place. So nobody like with just having a login and password would be able to access your VPN or some type of remote solution. The second one probably would be EDR solution, sophisticated EDR solution. And third, definitely backups. So on the priorities, like if, when you have a bunch of them, DLP probably would fall, I don't know, place number four, number five. And I think in that sense, just to put something that is not too sophisticated doesn't provide you the best return on investment.
Totally agree. Well, Yevgeny, thank you for letting me pick your brain for 20, 30 minutes. Well, thank you everyone for listening to Bytes of Insight here at Arete. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to marketing@areteir.com. Cheers, everyone, and have a great rest of your day.